Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Propaganda by propaganda organs by the United States government, that goes on all the time. But these are covert operations clearly designed for the purpose of regime change, and that is prohibited certainly by the United Nations Charter.
We're joined by international law expert Francis A. Boyle for a discussion about America's policy of regime change and a color revolution for Iran. Under former President Bush and Vice President Cheney, the U.S. was supporting opposition candidates, and in 2007, Bush authorized a covert black operation to destabilize the Iranian government, according to ABCnews.com. You can read a May 23, 2007 report about this operation in globalresearch.ca. Questions about Iran's election results persist, and they're more specific now that the Guardian Council of Iran has released more of the numbers. Professor Ali Ansari, an Iran expert at the London think tank Chatham House, is questioning the result of 13 million more votes for Ahmadinejad than the last election result produced. They point out that two districts produced more votes than eligible voters. A joint BBC and ABC News poll taken before the election did predict a vast turnout, 89%, with Ahmadinejad the winner of 2-1 over the leading contender Mir Hussein Mousavi. The poll was taken by the Center for Public Opinion of the New America Foundation.
On the basic question of whether I think Ahmadinejad won and won by a significant margin, yes, I continue to believe that is the case.
Former State Department, NSC, and CIA official Flint Leverett is now with the New America Foundation, and he has said he finds the Ahmadinejad win credible, even if the election result was imperfect.
It is overwhelmingly plausible that he won by a significant margin, and I think that there has been a real rush to judgment based on, you know, circumstantial evidence about the counting and, to some degree, on assumptions and wishful thinking.
The U.S. press has largely covered the political controversy surrounding Barack Obama's reaction to violence in Iran against election protesters. And some of the details of the election itself have not been well analyzed. For example, opposition candidates declined a proposed 10% recount early on. The 10% recheck standard for elections has in fact been used in some U.S. states. A spokesperson for opposition candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi told Al Jazeera only a fresh election would do. And on Tuesday, June 23rd, the opposition was offered a five-day extension to a deadline for looking into election complaints. It's not clear if the extension was accepted or if it's in place, but there was something of an answer in large street protests called by two remaining opposition candidates, Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi. There have been claims of massive arrests and large numbers of deaths during street protests, although the reports on numbers vary widely. At a press conference Tuesday, June 23rd, President Obama responded to questions about a video depicting the death of Neda Akha Soltan. She appears to have been shot by government troops during a protest in Tehran, June 20th.
Have you seen this video? What is your reaction?
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. And I think that anybody who sees it knows that there's something fundamentally unjust about that. And I think it's important for us to make sure that that we let the Iranian people know that we are watching what's happening, that they are not alone in this process.
The president issuing the strongest condemnation to date about Iranian authorities shooting protesters and engaging in other forms of repression. He also referred to Iran's suggestion about a U.S. role in the post-election dissent and demonstrations.
My role has been to say the United States is not going to be a foil for the Iranian government to try to blame what's happening on the streets of Tehran on the CIA or on the White House. That this is an issue that is led by and given voice to the frustrations of the Iranian people.
We turn now to internationally recognized legal expert Francis A. Boyle for a discussion on the legal and moral implications of America's Mideast policy. Francis A. Boyle is a Harvard scholar and has written and lectured extensively in the U.S. and abroad on the relationship between international law and politics. More recently, he has been a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. During the 90s, he served as legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Mideast peace negotiations, and he is author of many books, including his 2009 book, Tackling America's Toughest Questions, available online through ZNet. Professor Boyle, welcome.
Thank you for having me on, Dory, and my best to your listening audience.
Could the crisis in Iran evolve into a circumstance where the U.S. would get militarily involved?
I think what we are seeing behind the scenes is an attempt by the United States government to engineer another color revolution in Iran. I think the indicator of that was even the New York Times reported that a fellow named Jared Cohen at the State Department's Bureau of Policy Planning had called up Twitter and demanded that they stay open the weekend before last, despite the fact that they were scheduled to shut down for a periodic maintenance. And it seems to me that's probably the tip of the iceberg of what is going on here. The Bureau of Policy Planning at the State Department, Cohen's boss, is currently headed by Anne-Marie Slaughter. She was dean at Woodrow Wilson School during the Bush Jr. administration and president of the American Society of International Law, and did everything humanly possible at that time to promote and encourage war, a war of aggression against Iraq. And in addition, as part of this process, authored a completely reprehensible article arguing that, in fact, it would be better for the United States government to murder and assassinate their president, Saddam Hussein, and inflict regime change rather than invade Iraq as a preferable alternative. But, of course, she supported both, and ultimately that is what we did. So it does seem to me, if you put together Slaughter and Cohen and Twitter, that we are working behind the scenes. And remember, President Obama has stated that it's very important that the United States government not be seen to be involved. We know for a fact that President Bush Jr. signed a covert action determination calling for regime change in Iran. We know, again, documented reputable sources, that the United States government has been sponsoring covert actions, violent actions in Iran for the last several years, and has allocated several hundred million dollars towards that end. So my guess is that is what we see going on at this time.
It seems as if we're talking about more of the kind of propaganda work that we've seen the U.S. government do before. And then when you talk about activities possibly more aggressive, more militant, maybe at the Iranian border, we could be seeing more of the kind of strategy that came out of the Pentagon and even CIA, where we saw the hiring of these kind of covert agents to operate on our behalf, right?
Right. Legally, there is a difference, for example, between outright propaganda being broadcast by the United States against Iran, Voice of America, you know, Bureau of International Broadcasting and things of that nature. We do that all the time. Technically, there's nothing really illegal about it. Iran is trying to jam those broadcasts, and the BBC, too. And we have to understand all these agencies are direct arms of the United States government. There's nothing independent about them at all. But the covert operations that were authorized by President Bush Jr. and appear to be continued under the Obama administration, I think we're seeing a continuity in policy there. Those are clearly illegal interventions into the domestic affairs of Iran. So I would just draw the line legal, I guess, under international law, over propaganda by propaganda organs by the United States government. That goes on all the time. But these are covert operations clearly designed for the purpose of regime change, and that is prohibited certainly by the United Nations Charter.
We're going to take a moment to insert just a little bit of history here before getting back to our discussion with Professor Francis Boyle. By 2006, U.S. journalists and scholars like Dar Jamail, Seymour Hersh, and Francis A. Boyle expressed concern that the Bush administration's policy of regime change for Iran would include a military attack likely conducted with Israel. You can read about their concerns at our website, talknationradio.org. The University of Southern California's Muhammad Sahimi provides a detailed overview of the political climate in Iran in 2006 in his report, The Neoconservatives' Strategy for Regime Change in Iran. He argues that U.S. efforts to use the Persian press to build up opposition candidates in Tehran would likely be seen as propaganda. But there were other operations that seemed far more ominous. Guy Dinmore reported in the Financial Times of London that the U.S. Marine Intelligence Wing had launched a probe into Iran's ethnic minorities and were searching for any grievances against the Islamic government that could be exploited. The Pentagon was studying whether, like Iraq, Iran might be prone to violent fragmentation along ethnic lines. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Cheney, daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney, carried out a well-funded operation on behalf of the International Republican Institute. The institute had historically been used to funnel money from the National Endowment for Democracy into foreign aid projects. In August of 2003, in fact, former CIA agent Philip Agee tied the International Republican Institute to both the NED and the CIA. Elizabeth Cheney's Iranian operation was on behalf of the U.S. State Department and MEPI, the Iran-Middle East Partnership Initiative, as well as ISOG, the Iran-Syria Policy and Operations Group. In that capacity, she had millions of U.S. dollars at her disposal for propaganda, using radio outlets like the U.S.-owned Radio Farda and Voice of America. Meanwhile, the U.S. continued its covert operations at the Iraq-Iran border, even using the Mujahideen Khalq Organization, or MKO, listed by the U.S. State Department as a terrorist organization. Professor Boyle, what about this recent history with Elizabeth Cheney, her father, George W. Bush? Is it continuing, or is the Obama administration turning things in a different direction?
We're really seeing a continuation of the overt and covert policies under the Obama administration. And there have been terrorist attacks continuing in Iran under the Obama administration that were going on during the Bush administration. And the Iranian government has blamed these on the United States government, although they haven't done too much about it because they still are hoping that Obama will live up to his word and open some type of diplomatic negotiations with them. I don't know. I guess the Obama administration is going to try to see if they can inflict a color revolution on Iran, figuring that Mousavi and some of the others would be more amenable to their positions across the board than Ahmadinejad has been in the past. Although, you know, in fairness, if you read the letters and statements by Ahmadinejad, he has indicated he is prepared to sit down and negotiate in good faith with the Obama administration, but it does appear he's going to take a somewhat harder line than I guess the Obama people figure Mousavi and some of the others would if they were in power. So I think this is an attempt to try regime change first, and then, you know, if that doesn't work, things will calm down and then hopefully start. You recall there was this debate I heard on, I guess it was NPR, National Propaganda Radio, with Liz Cheney involved. Has diplomacy with Iran failed? Well, they've never tried diplomacy with Iran. There's been no diplomacy with Iran going back to the Iranian hostages crisis in 1979. As a matter of fact, under the previous president, Khatami, the Khatami government sent over a demarche to the United States government under Bush Jr., indicating that they were prepared to negotiate on all sources of disagreement between the United States and Iran, including Hamas, Hezbollah, the Palestinians, as well as nuclear enrichment and everything else. And that offer by their previous president was summarily rejected by the Bush administration under the influence of Vice President Cheney. And the Swiss diplomat who presented the demarche, Cheney et al., demanded that the Swiss government discipline him simply for conveying the offer.
President Obama told CNBC in an interview, quote, "The difference between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi in terms of their actual policies may not be as great as has been advertised." Professor Boyle, that history of Mousavi in power in Iran before, there have been some reports about repression, and the internet is just full of discussion about this. But what about this sort of mixed position of the Obama administration?
Well, again, I think as far as the United States government is concerned, if Mousavi and the rest of them came to power, there would be a change, and it might be more progressively in favor of United States positions than Ahmadinejad. But why not roll the dice, give it a try, see if there can be a color revolution, and then if not, they'll have to deal with Ahmadinejad. But yeah, the notion that Mousavi is some great reformer, I find difficult to believe. If you look at his background when he was in power, Professor Jim Petras just wrote an excellent piece on Counterpunch, pointing out the class nature of the two opponents. Ahmadinejad pretty much has the poor people, lower class, peasants, and others backing him. And Mousavi is basically speaking for bourgeoisie, professors, other educated people, elites, and things of that nature. It is important to keep in mind that in the last election, 2005, I think Ahmadinejad won by about 62%. And that's about his winning margin this time. I'm not saying there weren't irregularities over there. I'm sure there were, as there were in the U.S. presidential election of 2000. And then you have that article by the two pollsters in the Washington Post pointing out that according to their polls, Ahmadinejad was going to win pretty much by what he did win. So there's a lot there being manufactured by the U.S. news media that is virulently anti-Ahmadinejad and anti-Iranian to try to make it appear as if there is some great difference between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi.
And if we look historically at the way America goes to war, in the years leading up to it, we have seen U.S. intelligence operations run from high-powered campuses in the U.S., Yale, Harvard, others, and that there is a bit of a class component to it all in terms of who gets cultivated into human intelligence operations, right?
Right. Color operations have been run among these classes before in other countries where we've seen them, Yugoslavia, Georgia, Ukraine. There is a pattern here, yes. It seems to be appealing to the same groups of people to promote a color revolution, right?
And so the possibility exists, at any rate, that Mousavi is connected with international intelligence figures, regime changers who consider themselves maybe operating in a realm that private individuals can do more to engage in foreign policy successfully abroad than governments at times, that the policy of George H.W. Bush carried forward through things like solidarity. I mean, there was a lot of support for solidarity in Poland that came both covertly and overtly through these very same kinds of channels, as I recall.
I think that is correct, right? There was covert operations in support of solidarity and in cooperation with the Polish Pope at that time, sure.
There have been suggestions that the people of Iran are going through a process that they must enter into in order to ultimately wind up changing things. On the other hand, how much of a price do they need to pay?
You know, right now, from the latest reports I have read and heard, it does appear that the Mousavi people are realizing that there is not a great mass base of support around the country for what they're doing, and that perhaps they are going to step back a bit, and hopefully some type of compromise could be worked out that would not lead to further destabilization in Iran, and that perhaps, you know, the former president, Rafsanjani, is working behind the scenes to do that. There is an article in today's New York Times suggesting that Rafsanjani might be trying to play that role. Because I personally, you know, I'm not Iranian, but it would not seem to me that the destabilization of Iran, further destabilization, is in the interest of the Iranians. Because if you look at all the countries that have undergone these so-called color revolutions, I don't think it's done them any good.
What about the role of some of the other policymakers here under Obama? Talk about that some more and also explain more fully what the implications are of the role that's been played by individuals like Elizabeth Cheney at the State Department.
Well, as I said, my read of the situation is that the Obama administration has decided to try to inflict the color revolution on Iran and see if it works. And then if it doesn't work, or even if it does work, then they will have to sit down and proceed to negotiate with whoever is in power over in Iran. I still hope that is their intention. So that's the way I see it now. I think they're going to try the, as you correctly pointed out, this color revolution in Iran has been prepared, the groundwork prepared, for quite some time, going to the Bush Jr. administration and now continuing with Obama. And we even have the admission that this fellow Cohn at the Bureau of Policy Planning and the State Department is somehow involved in orchestrating it. That's my guess. They're going to try to roll the dice on a color revolution. And then if that doesn't work, then they'll have to see who they're dealing with and hopefully negotiate. It's pretty much like what's happening in Afghanistan now, where if you're reading the account, the Taliban indicated that they were prepared to negotiate with the United States government, with the Obama administration. And yet, rather than doing that, the Obama administration has now decided to escalate with 21,000 U.S. troops in the, I guess, calculation that they will be in a better position to negotiate from strength as they see it. Meanwhile, of course, they're setting off a catastrophe for the people in Pakistan. So rather than sit down and negotiate in good faith right at the start, they're in the process, as they see it, of improving their power position before they negotiate. So I think here in Iran, what we're seeing is trying to inflict the color revolution first before they negotiate and see what happens. By the way, Iranian policy, of course, overall, Obama's special representative on Iranian policy is Dennis Ross. And Dennis Ross is basically nothing more than a hatchet man and a spear carrier for the Israel lobby. He was there at the State Department until last week when it was announced he's now moving to the White House to personally advise Obama. So if you look at the cast of characters here, Anne-Marie Slaughter, Dennis Ross, dealing with Iran, certainly these people are malevolent to the core. Whether cooler heads will prevail in the future, I really don't know. One would hope so, but I just can't predict.
Professor Boyle, what about the continuity here? Running certainly from former Vice President Dick Cheney to daughter Elizabeth Cheney, both working toward regime change in Iran. And then there are longer-running operations of a similar kind, led by prominent U.S. political figures like former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski and even former Secretary of State under Nixon, Henry Kissinger, playing a role in D.C. again, right?
That's correct. Ross, certainly, who Obama did appoint as his point man on Iran and still his point man on Iran, is an Israel lobby guy. I was up against him in the Middle East peace negotiations for the Palestinians. I can assure you, Ross is more loyal to Israel than he is the United States of America. Slaughter, not much different from a neocon herself. She was good friends with Condoleezza Rice, and Rice appointed her to, I think it was something as silly as Rice's Democracy Promotion Committee there at the State Department, you know, if you can believe any of that. But, you know, that was the Bush propaganda. Right. We're just seeing a recycling of many of the architects of U.S. foreign policy for the past generation. General Jones at the National Security Council has publicly stated that he speaks with Henry Kissinger once a day. Brzezinski, when he worked for Carter as National Security Advisor, tried to orchestrate a military coup d'etat against the Iranian Revolution under Ayatollah Khomeini, run by a fellow named General Hauser. And it was that attempt by Brzezinski to inflict a coup d'etat to either put the Shah back in power or keep the Ayatollah out that led the students then to seize the U.S. embassy in Iran and to hold it for fear there was going to be another coup d'etat, as there had been in 1953 when the United States government overthrew the democratically elected Mossadegh government because it had nationalized the Iranian oil field and installed the Shah of Iran. Brzezinski was Obama's mentor at Columbia University, and behind Brzezinski, of course, is David Rockefeller. Brzezinski has been on the Rockefeller family payrolls, my understanding, since his days at Harvard. And the same was true for Kissinger. Kissinger has been on the Rockefeller family payroll from the very beginning of his academic career. And remember, it was Rockefeller who instructed Brzezinski to set up the Trilateral Commission. And Rockefeller and Brzezinski then co-opted a Georgia governor by the name of Jimmy Carter onto the Trilateral Commission. So we're sort of seeing here history repeating itself that I think they probably co-opted Obama as well. It's the same cast of characters, Richard Holbrooke. It doesn't surprise me at all. We're seeing the destabilization of Pakistan. We now have more refugees over there than the partition under the British of India-Pakistan, 2 million people at least, wholesale slaughter being set off by Richard Holbrooke over in Pakistan, perhaps threatening a civil war over there. Well, Holbrooke was the fellow in charge of handling the Balkans for President Clinton, and basically responsible for the massacre at Srebrenica that, 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were killed. Holbrooke, who's completely ruthless and unprincipled. If you look at the cast of characters around Obama advising him on foreign affairs, defense, counterterrorism, it's pretty much business as usual.
And just go over what the business interests are in this part of the world.
If you look at Central Asia and the Persian Gulf, they're two-thirds of the world energy supplies there in oil and gas, and certainly that's the control of the future of the world economic system right there. Despite statements by Obama, we're not really leaving Iraq. We still have 130,000 troops there, and they're even talking about a residual force of at least 50,000 in Iraq itself. There'll be more in Kuwait. Even Sam Huntington of Harvard, in his book Clash of Civilizations, argued after Gulf War I by Bush Sr. that the Persian Gulf has now become an American lake. And the reason we are over there is to control and dominate all that oil and gas. And that's how Iran also fits into the picture as well. They probably have, after Saudi Arabia and Iraq, the world's third largest supply. And either they do what we tell them to do, or else we'll inflict regime change, and then if necessary, if that doesn't work, use military force.
Harvard scholar Francis A. Boyle has written and lectured extensively in the U.S. and abroad on the relationship between international law and politics. We will post more of this interview at our website, talknationradio.org. A leading international scholar and expert who has been teaching at the University of Illinois College of Law, Professor Francis A. Boyle has served as legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to Mideast peace negotiations. He is author of many books taking on questions of international law in the U.S. and abroad. His latest book is Tackling America's Toughest Questions. Talk Nation Radio is syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. I'm Dori Smith. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com for information or to comment on the show, and go to talknationradio.org to listen to this program again or find audio and transcripts of other shows.